Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience and psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
And this week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Yulia Buentanita,
who is a human-computer interaction researcher
at Tilburg University. We had Yulia on to talk about Uncanny Valley, which was very exciting. So Uncanny Valley is an experience that you see something and it feels kind of right, wrong. And it's this thing of you're in the Uncanny Valley. So if you Google it, it'll come up like strange kind of faces, this kind of thing. But people use it now to describe things in art or, yeah, just something where it feels a little off or eerie and you can't put your finger on why. It was super exciting to hear the history of the Uncanny Valley, what it means for how we interact with robots and all that stuff. So hope you guys enjoy.
Hi, I'm Yulia Buentanita. I'm a lecturer in the Department of Cognitive Science and AI at Tilburg University. I'm based in the Netherlands and I broadly work on digital technology, you could say. So that includes virtual agents, but also machine learning applications. And I'm also very much interested in applying technology to specific fields, for example, healthcare. So I have my work revolves around these two broad domains, one of which is cognitive science and kind of perception and then virtual agents technology. And another is more like computational modeling of data.
So today we're going to talk about some of your knowledge of Uncanny Valley. So could you describe what Uncanny Valley is and when it's used in research, how do people define it? And why do you think something like this has such a strong psychological effect?
So the Uncanny Valley is this theory or idea that is very prominent in human-computer interaction, robotics. But basically, it also kind of rippled down to other fields like psychology or design. And the backstory about it is that in 1970, this Japanese roboticist Masahiro Mori came up with this kind of idea. It's not really, it didn't start out as a scientific kind of theory. It was just idea that basically he was trying, based on his experience with robots, he was trying to explain this phenomenon that he started noticing that if you take two things, which is how an artifact that could be a robot, or later on people started talking about virtual humans. So a robot, let's say, and the extent to which it's human-like or not, one thing. And on the other hand, you take how people relate to that entity. If you kind of start to vary these things, that at some point when the artifact becomes more realistic, people also kind of find that they can relate to it better. So they have this positive feeling. But then you would expect that this goes like at infinitum, but actually at some point when the entity is almost human-like, but it's not authentically, people have this dip in affinity. So basically, this is what kind of research, a lot of studies showed that you have this kind of dip. If you try to plot these two things, other studies didn't show that. So all the kind of the evidence is mixed. But basically, yeah, Mori proposes Uncanny Valley idea. And then it's caught up and became quite famous in human-computer interaction. So yeah, it's one of the most famous theories. As to why it happens, there are theories why it might happen. And some propose that maybe it's actually that it's something about the inconsistency of features. So it's like cognitive dissonance idea, right? Because like in real life, we only encounter entities that are human-like, that are humans. Only fairly recently in our history, we have artifacts that started to resemble a human form, right? So maybe something to do with that, like others proposed, like maybe it's fear of mortality, etc. Like all the like, kind of some kind of more intrinsic response. Like the origins of something is, this is very difficult to study. So because it's, yeah, relates to human mind. So I don't think anybody actually knows why it happens.
I suppose then, does that mean it really is just started off in a theory in robotics and then people applied it to art and other things? Because I feel like now people describe it in all sorts of ways that they, in different situations where they feel like they're experiencing it.
Indeed, we sometimes say, oh, it's like it has uncanny feel, right? So it's, I guess, in the, yeah, we use it in all different ways. But as the concept, it started in robotics like 50 years ago, whereby this person proposed it as this like almost impressionistic idea. And he wrote an essay about it. And then actually someone translated it to English. And that only then like experimental studies started. So as far as experiments go, it's been maybe now 20 years people have been studying this, and most prominently in the human computer interaction field. And then maybe before that, people were writing about it, I don't know, maybe in the arts and in design. But basically, if we take my field, so this is just like the last 20 years.
And with the research that's coming out, do we know what happens in the brain when we encounter something that falls in the uncanny valley? Is it a cognitive process? Is it an emotional process? Is it a mix of all of them? Do we know that yet?
Yeah, we know some of it. I guess also in my work, I have this paper where I try to look at the different studies in the neurological domain. Because the thing with this theory is that a bunch of work has been done behaviorally, really relying on subjective reports, which we know sometimes are not the most reliable. There are a lot of inconclusive findings because, first of all, different stimuli being used across different kind of studies, then the way they kind of ask people, sometimes it's affinity, sometimes it's how much, to what extent do you like, et cetera, right? So it's all subjective, which produces also a bunch of different, sometimes contradictory findings, if you look at behavior and subjective reports. So then I think it's better to try to involve more objective measures, which kind of, yeah, one can argue whether that's really more objective, right? Or, but still, the way the processes that happen at the brain level would be more objective, right? So I was looking at the time I was for this paper, I tried to collate the existing studies on the uncanny valley in the neurological domain. So the ones that used, let's say, fMRI, fNIRS, EEG, so all these like different techniques that are good either in the spatial domain of imaging the brain or the temporal domain, EEG, for example. And I tried to make sense of those studies by really involving kind of psychological theories as well. So for example, dividing them, okay, there's this bucket of studies that look at face perception. So let's take also how in the brain the faces are processed, right? Okay, let's relate to the areas in the brain. Or there's another bucket of studies that seem to be doing stuff where they look at the kind of motion, movement processing of in robots or like virtual humans. And then the third bucket that I found was the studies, some of them that looked at the theory of mind, which is like really trying to make sense of what other people think based on what they do. So it's really this idea in psychology. And then a couple of findings emerge. So I guess the biggest finding and kind of a gap in the field is that there aren't that many studies that specifically look at the kind of emotional processing. Funnily enough, this theory is about affect and emotion, but not many really kind of look at the brain areas related to that. So this is funny. But then if you look at those three buckets, so when it comes to what I found regarding, let's say, face perception, there is a difference, actually, when we process the faces of social robots, virtual agents that are not full-blown human-like agents, the areas in the brain that are responsible for face processing, so to say, less engaged. And that kind of makes sense in the perspective of my own work. We can later discuss that as well. But basically, there is this, you have to take into account that overall, there aren't that many studies in neurology and on the uncanny valley, but there is some signal that to me seems to be actually true signal, that actually if you have an artifact that is not human-like, simply the brain areas that are specialized really for faces, for biological signals. We are really, as humans, good at that because we have had historically so much experience with processing human faces, human motion, etc. So these areas are deactivated. Then if you look at motion perception, and not per se motion perception, but more inferring people's goals based on motion, right? So all the kinematic details, and not per se kinematic details, but really how we infer what the person is going to do in the next 2-3 seconds based on how they move. So let's say when you're going to reach out for something, right? There are those studies in kinematics and so on. So there I found actually based on a couple of studies that we are able to, It's the same. We are able to infer the goals that are produced by humans and the same by robots. So really, when it comes not to really kind of just goal inference, it's a very similar response, which also to me made sense, right? So it's not about how something is done, but actually kind of the mirror neuron theories and so on, right? So the process is there, right? And then when it came to theory of mind, so really, if, let's say, the context where I'm interacting with an artifact, a robot, and I try to also infer, okay, the behavior, right? So I make up some theory why the robot behaves the way it behaves, although, of course, it doesn't have theory of mind. And there you see that actually there was a bit of a difference. It seemed that also we engage more abstract social processing in with respect to, let's say, processing, kind of inferring the goals of robots, which in a way also makes sense to me because I guess what your brain is trying to do, it's like you are faced with this artifact that, of course, you don't have like perceptually much experience. So I think then the brain is more probably doing kind of more object processing almost. In a way, it's more abstract rather than what we use the processes in social cognition that we engage in human interactions.
Okay, that was super interesting. And I have a question, but when you're explaining the differences between when we see a robot, the areas that process faces and everything aren't as engaged, do you think that we will evolve to have a separate processing systems when we interact with robots and that will remove uncanny valley? Or do you think we'll get so used to the robots, we'll just start processing them in the same way because we're more used to them and we like evolve with them? Does that make sense?
It does make sense, a lot of sense, but I think it's like still an empirical question actually, because I think the difference when it comes to kind of social signal processing, right, that the way we process robots' faces and like facial expressions and like movement. So it's not that we engage the systems that we use in human interactions to do that, right? Because if I see, let's say, okay, let's take the faces of kind of virtual agents or like kind of Gen AI images, right? So the stimulus that you see there, it's like really the same as human, right? Kind of images, for example, or videos. So of course you are engaging the same areas that you're using in kind of human interactions. It's just like what we do, right? So it's, yeah. So when it comes to really kind of social perception, when it comes to probably the interaction, it could be, I don't think it would be preposterous to say that maybe at some point, actually, we will develop specialized mechanisms in the brain to process these entities, right? Because if you look at the brain, right, so the people who learn to read, right, so they also develop this kind of mechanisms in the brain that are only the brain changes in being able to parse the letters, right? So it can happen really quickly, like it doesn't have to be like evolutionary process. Yeah. So it's totally kind of possible to me. But I think technologically where we are headed, I think for better or for worse, we are headed to a future where we are going to be creating these replicas of humans. And I think then it's really, visually, it does look like a human. It sounds like a human. It behaves maybe like a human. But then in terms of all the psychological, how we relate to that entity psychologically, emotionally, I don't know, like what sort of processes we will be developing. And we already pretty much attached to our devices, right? So I don't know about all the Gen AI and then the other stuff. But to briefly answer the last part about the uncanny valley, I think in a way, it's maybe becoming obsolete theory because it technologically has become possible to create replicas of humans. And already that started almost a decade ago in terms of, let's say, computer graphics and so on, and only kind of behavioral aspects like creating a convincing behavior for, let's say, social robots, virtual agents has been difficult. But I guess now with all the large language models, foundational models, that's gonna become even also possible.
So Ava, this was exciting. This was a fan suggestion, but I don't know if Veronica and Danny were going to be labeled as fans. They're my friends. But they were like, can you do a podcast on Uncanny Valley? And the reason that this came up is they were visiting me in Australia and our whole trip was beautiful. Everything was amazing. And they were like, oh, we're having this experience of Uncanny Valley because it feels slightly like America, but then it's so different. So it wasn't like a totally, oh, going somewhere entirely new where it's like, oh, this falls into this category. And they're like, oh, it feels like Uncanny Valley. Also, because everyone was so nice, like waving to each other. And they're like, oh, this feels like Uncanny Valley. What is that?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I feel like it hits on one of the thoughts on what it is, which is like that there's just something unsettling because it's close enough. And also, I think based on some of what Yulia was talking about, it's close enough, but also it's like too good. Like in some ways, like there's something off because your skin is too smooth. The people are too nice. There's something like Stepford Wives-y about it, which yeah. I think is interesting because I think we typically think of like goodness as going in the direction of like you would be perfect. You would have this great skin, whatever. But it's actually in those things that are a bit off that we can perceive realness.
Yeah, that's exactly. That was an example when we're in Sydney. It was free sunscreen. So like, why is everything in Australia free? There's water, public toilets, all this stuff. And then we go to Sydney and there's actually like free sunscreen in the town square. And yeah, exactly. They're like, this feels a bit Stepford Wives-y. Like, why is everything like this? Do you have any Uncanny Valley experiences?
I was just thinking about Uncanny Valley. And one thing that I thought was interesting about it was that I feel like it's very visual. Because, and I don't exactly know why, but I feel like with voices for some reason, and I don't know if it's maybe because we've been used to kind of robot-y voices for longer, that I feel like it would be hard for me to feel Uncanny Valley in a voice. The only time that I've felt that is like in 2001 Space Odyssey with Hal. But I think that's not because it was Uncanny Valley. I think it's because it was just like a creepy thing. So I think sometimes the creepiness maybe can be conflated with Uncanny Valley. But I think it's something similar of like this voice seems too real, but then it's a robot. But I feel like it's so the unsettling part of it, I feel like it's so visual. Like when you see those flesh robots interacting, like that feels, I don't know, like curdly to me. But with a voice, I don't think I would feel like that. And maybe even... I guess I've never like touched a robot. Maybe if a robot hugged me, I would be freaked out by it. If there was a fake beating heart or something.
Oh, I don't like that.
But do you feel that it's very tied to one of the senses?
Yeah, because I think also when they have those weird moving dog robots.
Yeah.
That I get a lot when I see that, and that's very
really
unusual. Like them, like they're fighting or moving around strangely. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Are you talking about like actual little dogs or like the scary ones? Like the ones that are like, attack ones?
Yeah, and they move around.
But I guess it is that.
Yeah, because I feel they have the movement to mimic how humans move or alive things move. But then it feels wrong.
I guess Yulia was talking about it too, but with motion, that can seem off. And I feel like even sometimes when you interact with a real person, sometimes if someone is giving a talk or on stage somewhere and they're like really stilted. I feel like this is another case where you're like, Uncanny Valley is just for fake things. Like this is for like robots are not people. I'm like, they're almost the same. Because actually in your conversation with Yulia, you were saying whether we might develop different kind of categorizations maybe neurally for robots and human faces. One thing first I wanted to talk about was some research on like how we perceive faces neurally. And then I want to play a game with you.
Okay, yay.
Okay, so essentially there is an area of the brain that is super activated whenever there's faces on screen or that you see a face. And people have known about it since like maybe early 2000s. And it's been one of the most researched areas of the brain, but also one of the areas that has had the most kind of controversy. And the reason for this is that a lot of researchers were arguing this is a face-specific area, and it's actually called fusiform face area, or gyrus. But then people realized that it actually was also lighting up for other things that you had expertise in. So people who were like expert bird watchers or who were super into cars, when you showed them different cars and you showed them different birds, they also had activation there. So then it became this huge point of discussion of whether it's just for faces or whether it's just about expertise. And as humans, we're experts in perceiving other people's faces. So that's why we have so much activation there. One of the cool things that they did also, which I think is relevant to the robot faces, is that some researchers trained people to recognize these different kind of blobs. I think they called them greebles. And they trained them to look at these different blobs. And then over time, once they got really good at discerning the different blobs, then the face area started lighting up as well. So I feel like we kind of already have the machinery in place to do that. And later, because these original studies were using what's called univariate analyses, where it's basically like super coarse type of analysis, where you can just see like in a relatively large kind of chunk of the brain, whether there's activation or not. But now people have been able to do more fine-grained analyses where you can look at the pattern of the activation in that region rather than just on average, how much is it lighting up. And you can really tell in that region, like even if it's someone who's an expert in cars, whether they're looking at a car or whether they're looking at a face. So I feel like we have that machinery in place, and maybe we'll just have like people who are really good at discerning robot faces versus human faces. But I feel like you'll know what I'm going to say. And I think that everyone is just going to, I think we're going to merge with the robots. So I think that we're all going to, that machinery is just going to be taken over by one humanoid robot thing.
I thought that's what you'd think was going to happen.
Yeah.
I really loved at the end when I asked Yulia, oh, we're not going to be able to make a robot like a human because we're so complicated. And she was like, that actually doesn't matter.
I love that too. I was like, yes, I so agree with that.
Because we're so easily convinced and want to believe in things. And I would say, oh, that was, I was convinced by that argument, actually.
The game I want to play with you.
Okay.
Is about, I'm just curious to see what happens, but.
Should I Google it?
I'll send you the link. It's called whichfaceisreal.com. Have you done it?
No.
Unfortunately, I can't see your faces with you. I'm really bad at it.
Whichfaceisreal.com?
So there's two faces side by side, and one of them is not real, and the other person has a real face, and you have to choose who's real and who's not.
Okay. Oh, God, this is hard.
It's hard. Okay, so the questions are, is the Uncanny Valley dead? And do we even need a new machinery because it's right there?
I got the first one correct.
Okay, nice.
Keep play going. Again?
Yeah, right. Keep going.
Who is real? What? Who I'm gonna play is too. Real? I got it wrong.
It's scary, right?
Oh, there's ones of kids. I don't like that. That feels really wrong. Oh, I think I got to opt out. I'm getting out. It feels, I don't like that. All right.
I just wanted to show you because Yulia was talking about when they did their project and were able to generate these human-like faces. And this, I think, is technology from like 2018 or 2019. So actually it's quite old. But I think we're failing this visual Turing test. And when I first saw this, I was so shocked. And I couldn't believe that these faces were generated. And there's a similar website. I think it's something like, this is not a real person. And it just shows you pictures of people that are generated and they look so real. So I'm kind of like, are we past the phase of Uncanny Valley, at least with static images?
And I think that's what Yulia would say is, she's all we've passed Uncanny Valley.
Scary.
But what I find hard about that website, I feel more okay with mistaking a fake thing for a real thing. What I don't feel okay with is seeing a real thing and picking the fake thing over the real thing. That's where I felt. Does that make sense? So seeing a fake face and being like, oh, that's real. I'm like, okay, that doesn't feel great, but whatever. But then comparing a real person compared to a fake thing and picking the fake thing as real, that's where I'm like, wow. So there's someone who's real there and I'm not able to decipher that they're real.
Yeah. I'll tell you something that maybe will make you feel better.
Okay.
Which is that if you do this a bunch of times, if you train yourself on it, you get better. And then you almost never fail. So there's still something that we can discern. I think some people are better than others. I remember I had my mom do this like a couple years ago and she was so good.
Oh,
like,
cool.
I think she never got one wrong. And she was like, I don't see what you're seeing. She was like, none of these look real to me. So I think that is also something that is hopeful in terms of, I guess now we're talking about moving past the uncanny valley, but that hopefully we'll be able to still tell that something is AI or something's not AI and something's real or not. I think I already get fooled online a lot of the times. I catch myself thinking something's real when it's not. I think our brains are more powerful than we think and are more plastic than we think, but I'm just not sure that we'll be able to keep up with the pace that AI is moving.
Yeah, because imagine if you were on that website and someone made a decision that you were the non-real one. How would that feel?
I think this is another case of like, that wouldn't bother me at all.
I'd be like, no, I'm real, I tell you, I'm real.
Yeah, but what if you coded the AI to think that they were real too? They would say the same thing.
Another thing I'm just curious, when designing robots to be like humans, because humans have error, is one of the design features is to create robots that purposely make mistakes and have error so they feel more human?
That can be one of the ways. And actually, my prior project, actually the project that I did my PhD on, it was a project where we were creating a set of virtual agents for healthcare applications. And at that time, that was pre-LLM, pre-foundation models. So we also were using different techniques, let's say, to generate a language and so on. And at the time, there were times when we would sit down and brainstorm the little things that make us humans, and making errors is one of the features, right? The other feature, if you look at, let's say, language and speech, so we have all these fluences, right? So, right? And we also have like a particular cadence, and the gap between like when I start speaking and you start speaking is very short. So there are like these little things that make us, I guess, humans that you can use as tricks to actually kind of in robotics and virtual agent technology. And I'm not super maybe well versed in, let's say, in human robots and robotics, like, but I think people have used, like, indeed, they kind of had robots that do make mistakes. And of course, people in a way like that because you have this perception that it's human-like, right? For sure, like, we are so kind of, I guess, also enamored with ourselves, right? That we relate better to something that looks like us.
So now to speak about some of your work that's looked at the importance of skin and eyes when we determine human likeness. Could you explain this work and maybe how like those findings could impact our uncanny valley experiences?
Yeah, so I guess you're referring to the work, one of my perceptual studies. I really was intrigued by this question. Like I said, I started around that time where it became possible to generate realistic, let's say, images, like renderings of human faces, human bodies. There's been a lot of progress in computer graphics in the last really 15 years. And around 2018, already it was possible to create, and again, this was pre-gen AI, it was already possible to create, let's say, images of what looked like kind of full-blown humans. And I was really curious whether people could tell the difference when they look at the photograph or when they look at, let's say, a rendering of a virtual human. what I did there, I really took at the time a set of those virtual agent faces, images, and I'm in one of the experiments, I intermixed them with a set of real human photographs drawn from a database. And I simply asked people to rate them on human likeness. And what emerged is that actually people at the time, at least in my study, were able to tell them apart. Basically, there was like a slight difference, like both were close in terms of human likeness perception, but there was a kind of statistically significant difference, which means that there's a difference. And then I was still curious, why is there such difference still? And then I thought about two features that could be driving this. So one, the eyes. And specifically in the eyes, I was focused on the corneal reflections. So what those are, so basically, since the surface of our eyes has this thin film of tear, when the light from the environment when the light reflects from the eye, basically, you have this kind of corneal reflection, really the white highlights in the eyes sometimes that you see in the photos or in general. And so I took this feature, and then the other feature, I thought that maybe it has to do something with the skin appearance, basically skin texture. So let's say in humans, we have skin textures are not perfectly smooth. We have like pores and imperfections and so on. It looked like at that time, those virtual human faces that I took, they were really perfectly like super smooth skin and not super. So maybe I thought this is like also another giveaway. And basically what I did in one of the experiments, I computationally measured the number of corneal reflections in images and in both classes of images, in humans and virtual agents. And then I also measured how smooth versus how rough the skin texture was, also like just kind of, it was image analysis. And then I found that there was a difference, actually, if you look at just statistically at the photos, virtual human faces tended to have fewer corneal reflections, at least, again, the ones that I took. And then they had, on average, smoother skin texture. And then in another experiment, I simply took human faces and I altered these features. I removed corneal reflections from the photos and I smoothened the skin texture. And actually, then I gave those photos to my participants. I did find that actually these features were responsible for judging the face as human-like or not. And I still did some experiments where I was intermixing virtual agent faces with human faces. So what that tells in a nutshell, actually, that of course, when we look at faces, we preferentially orient to specific parts of the face. And actually, there is some sort of a hierarchy in the face processing. And the eyes are terribly important, but also the tiny features, like as we just were speaking, like all the details that make us humans, right? And we have those details just because we are based in a physical world, right? Whereas if you are trying to create a virtual human, you almost have to replicate the kind of all the physics of the kind of the world if you want to have realistic, at least at the time you need that. Maybe not so much these days. And the same regarding the skin. This is again, if you look at the kind of global face processing, we do take in the global information from the just also skin appearance.
Do you think in our lifetime, we will interact with a robot where we cannot tell the difference? And do you think that's something we should be aspiring to create? And then what roles would these robots serve? Like where are the benefits in that?
Very interesting question. A lot to unpack, I guess. I think that in a way we are, or at least these days, some people are already interacting with, let's say, language models as if there is no difference. So maybe you are familiar with these companies like Replica or Character AI, where you can create an agent, like a chatbot, basically, with whom you can interact, actually. And from, let's say, some stories reported in the media, like whereby people fall in love or like really strike up an emotional relationship. So in a way, I think this is already happening in terms of like physical embodiments, like social robots. Perhaps, I don't know if we are going to create like really high fidelity robots that look very human-like. Maybe that's also going to happen in robotics at some point. In virtual agents, I think, again, it's almost happening already. At least they look from the visual appearance human-like. Maybe not yet so much sometimes in behavior, but I guess this is coming. Then whether it's a good or bad thing, yes, it's almost like ethics philosophy, right? If you ask my personal opinion, I don't think this is a super good thing, actually. Or at least I think the human should always know that they are interacting with an artifact. I think we should not like pass those entities as kind of humans, because they are not humans. They are pieces of technology. But in terms of like specific applications, I think that there are like beneficial uses where you do have this kind of replica of a human, let's say a virtual agent, for example, in healthcare, where you would want, for example, also to come back to my project previously. So one of the ideas why we were building these virtual agents for healthcare was actually to have them as assistants. For example, if you are undergoing an operation, instead of reading leaflets or Googling stuff online, you could be chatting with a kind of in natural language with a virtual agent that could be giving you like guidance how to prepare on your operation or about the complications. And chatting like this, the way we are doing now, is the most natural form of communication. So I think there's a lot of potential. And the same applies to, let's say, education, for example, where you could be having virtual tutors that could be looking like behaving in a way, yeah, as human tutors. But of course, again, the person should always know it's just a technology. I think it's pretty complex, the fact that we are recreating ourselves in the hardware and then software. That's bizarre. I don't know. Like it also raises a lot of philosophical questions why the field has moved towards that. But it's probably, you have to look at it case by case probably to see whether it's more detrimental than beneficial.
I study computational psychiatry, so it's how mechanisms behind anxiety and depression. And I'm like, well, we know nothing about humans. We know nothing about the brain. We know so little, and it would be great to know so much more. So I always, when I think about AI and robotics, I'm skeptical that we'll be able to create something. I guess because I'm like, how will we be able to replicate all the things about us when we don't even know them about ourselves?
That's a very good point. The funny thing about humans, that to believe something, we don't need that much, actually. So you just need to have the universe in a physics engine to feel in a universe. I don't know if so. Actually, just a couple of those cues are sufficient to evoke this affinity with technology and so on. So I feel like as long as it can have some level, which like technologically we have achieved, at least like from visual perception, it doesn't have all the, I do agree with you that having a model, even we don't have the models of the brain even for mice, right? So how are you going to have to how are you going to model the mechanisms in humans where you can't model them in smaller animals? But I feel like for us, for our minds to relate to something, it doesn't need that much. So you probably will know about this phenomenon, pareidolia, right? Why we know we are not familiar. So it's basically if you have a cloud looks like a face, like what happens at the brain level, we do actually for the first like 100 milliseconds, we engage the same face processing mechanisms when we think it's a cloud looks like a face. So we don't need that much actually.
That's a really good point. Yeah, it probably doesn't matter if the robots have our complete likeness because, yeah, we are easily.
I think so. At least I think so.
Yeah, that's a very good point. This has been awesome. Do you just want to finish by letting us know what you're excited about, what you're working on next?
Sure. I'm still working on a couple of lines of work. So actually, one of them is really what we discussed now in terms of how humans relate to technology, AI, virtual agents, how we perceive, let's say, AI. That kind of interests me, and how to create tools to better measure that, let's say, that those perceptions. On the other hand, I'm super interested in applying machine learning to healthcare, and also to a bit to the aging field. So how can we actually measure human cognitive performance using various metrics, for example, behavioral, but also neurophysiological, to actually, let's say, in a healthy population, actually to better understand where people lie on the spectrum of their cognitive capacities.
Thank you to Dr. Yulia Boitanita for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is created and co-hosted by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madasuza. This episode was edited by Bhumika Velineni, and you can find social media content on our Instagram at Minds Matter Podcast and TikTok at Minds Matter Pod, created this week by Monica Lee. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.